Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, F.J. at offbeatoregon.com with the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. And it's Friday, which means this is going to be a brand new show, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Reruns are for Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. Fridays are for new stuff. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on January 13th of 2019 under the headline Shorty Davis May Be Oregon's Oldest Cold Case. Here we go. The disappearance of sheep rancher Shorty Davis has got to be Central Oregon's oldest cold case. There are older unsolved crimes, but it's hard to think of an older one that people are still thinking about. It's been almost 120 years since the affable, odd-looking pioneer vanished, and locals are still spinning theories about what might have happened. The most popular theory, then and now, is that he was a victim of the last round of the Oregon Range Wars, the Crook County sheep shooters outbreak of 1896 to 1906. Another good possibility, supported by local resident Dorothy Lawson McLean, Governor Tom McCall's mother, by the way, is that he was murdered by one of his neighbors, an ill-tempered cattleman who later proved the low quality of his character by perpetrating a murder-suicide on his wife after some financial setbacks. Whatever happened, it seems to have left no trace of the stockman. He took with him only his horse, his saddle, and, some sources say, a gun. He left behind 800 acres of good ranch land, roughly 3,000 head of sheep, about 60 cattle, 14,000 pounds of wool in the barn ready to be shipped to market, and lots of very puzzled friends. A $1,000 reward was promptly offered for anyone who could find him or his body. No one ever claimed it. Shorty Davis first came to Crook County when it was still part of Wasco County in 1881. The year before the formation and reign of terror of Colonel William Bud Thompson and his Prineville vigilantes. As a general rule, all men nicknamed Shorty are either very short or very tall, and in Shorty's case, it was the former. He was a powerful, barrel-chested man, with very long arms and an unusually large head, but with very short legs. It was as if he were a dwarf from the waist down and a giant from the waist up. He was a dark man, olive-skinned, with black hair. And there seems to have been something about him that inspired friendship and trust. Upon arrival as a penniless laborer in his mid-twenties, he immediately started working for local sheep outfits, taking his pay in sheep at the end of each season and acquiring land every chance he got. By 1894, he had a substantial acreage, three quarter sections, plus a ranch with a house and barn on it. He also had a big flock of sheep. But 1896 was the year a group of cattle ranchers got together to do something about the quote-unquote sheep problem. The increasing popularity of sheep ranching in Central Oregon was putting pressure on the publicly owned rangeland. Legally, anyone was allowed to graze anything on that land at any time, but the cattlemen felt that since they had been there first, well, actually, they personally hadn't, but there had been cows on the range before there had been sheep, they should be entitled to first rights on it. They decided that when they found a flock of sheep grazing on public land that they had, quote-unquote, claimed for their gang, they would sneak up on the sheep herder, tie him up, and massacre the sheep. They took their style and tactics from Thompson and the vigilantes, wearing masks and riding by night and sending anonymous, sinister, threatening messages to anyone who opposed them. In fact, historian David Braley reports that a number of them had been members of the vigilantes 15 years before. And so, slowly at first but with increasing boldness over the following decade or so, they started doing this. By the time a long-suffering and exasperated federal government ended the squabble by establishing a grazing permit system, tens of thousands of sheep had met an untimely end at their hands. Shorty, of course, had a lot of sheep and ran them on lands that the cattlemen were pleased to think of as their own turf. So tensions rose as the 1890s ripened into the dawning of the new century. Then, one mid-August day in 1900, Shorty's neighbors heard a big commotion at his ranch. All the animals were bawling and bleating. They were, as it turned out, hungry. Shorty had apparently left without feeding them. Or maybe he didn't leave. In any case, he was never seen again. Shorty was declared dead less than a month later. which seems unusually hasty even by the standards of a century ago, but Shorty had a lot of valuable property and most likely some of the would-be bidders were well-connected. They would have wanted to hurry things up before any relatives could find out and spoil the party. If that was the reason for the rush, the tactic worked. Shorty's relatives wouldn't learn of his disappearance for several years after it happened. Meanwhile, a desultory run of advertisements and nearby papers didn't turn up any heirs, so his stock and land were auctioned off, and the bidders got the land and stock for about 15 cents on the dollar of its actual value. Meanwhile, the sheepshooters were getting increasingly bold. In 1903 alone, they killed over 10,000 sheep. Community opinion was starting to turn against them, as it had with the vigilantes 2 decades before, and for similar reasons. They were powerful, scary, anonymous, and accountable only to themselves. Plus, they hated sheepmen. It was only natural that suspicion would fall on them for Shorty's disappearance. In 1905, a witness in a land fraud trial in Portland claimed Shorty had been murdered and dumped into an old dry well on his property. The well was excavated. It contained no trace of Shorty. Apparently, the witness had made up the story just on the off chance that the murderer had disposed of the body that way so that he could snag the $1,000 reward. In 1909, a spring flood exposed some bones in a creek bed near Prineville, and on the basis of that evidence, Charles Colby, the neighboring cattle rancher who had feuded with Shorty, was arrested. He was released for lack of evidence, although Dorothy Lawson McLean remained personally convinced of his guilt. The bones, apparently, not Shorty's. By that time, though, Shorty's relatives had been found. His real name, it turned out, was Leonidas Douris. He was a Greek by birth. He had changed his name to conceal himself from other Greeks, including his relatives who would put the bite on him for loans and then never pay them back. Shorty was a nice guy, apparently too nice for his own good and therefore easy to take advantage of. It had become a big enough problem that he literally went on the lam with his friends and family to short-circuit it. Shorty's brothers came to town to wrap up all his affairs and collect and distribute what was left of his estate, but there was still no trace of Shorty himself. Over the following years, Shorty Davis became something like an obsession and remained so for decades afterwards. The family that bought his old farmhouse got used to knocks on the door from fresh-faced Shorty hunters wanting to poke around the property. Rumors directed others to a particular rock at the mouth of Sanford Creek. In the early 1950s, a skeleton was unearthed during construction of a new bridge, and the first words on everyone's lips were, "We found Shorty!" But they hadn't. It was someone else. Most recently, in March 2008, Shorty's grandniece, Anastasia Douris, came to the U.S. to learn more about him. The family back in Greece had heard that he'd been murdered by cowboys who had taken over his ranch. She found that, far from being a forgotten victim of Old West violence, her relative was Prineville's municipal mystery, still. So what really happened to Shorty Davis? It seems unlikely that if he died of natural causes, no body would have been found. During the years when a $1,000 reward was being offered, people were crawling all over the landscape looking for clues. If he'd drowned in a river, his horse would have been found. If his horse had slipped off a trail and over a cliff, someone would have found the bodies or bones. So it's most likely that someone hid him deliberately, presumably after murdering him. And if that's the case, unless his murderer was incompetent, we'll almost certainly never know. Key sources in this story included works by Anastasia Douris, Katie Wennerstrom, and David Braley. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. By the way, the hardcover edition of Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, the first in what I anticipate will be a series of 8 offbeat Oregon history books, is now out in hardcover. It's had time to percolate out into all the systems at the bookstore, so you can find it at Powell's and Barnes & Noble, in addition to Amazon, and of course local outfits. The hardcover is a bit pricey, at just under $40, but it comes with the ebook and audiobook as downloadable bonus content. The standalone audiobook is still under review at Audible right now, but hopefully in a couple weeks, that will be out as well. These books are based on columns that you'll be familiar with from this podcast, but I've done some additional digging and researching, and in several cases, the stories changed and improved rather a lot. Basically, what I did was to treat the columns as rough drafts and re-research and rewrite them. If you do pick up a copy, let me know what you think. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m. So if you're a subscriber, the next installment will be on your device and ready for you to listen to before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.